Okay, I'm going to call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect that the time is currently 1:36 p.m. on Tuesday, April 6th, 2021. And present today, we have Representative Thompson, Representative LeBon, Representative Edgman, Representative Ortiz, Representative Merrick, Representative Rasmussen, Representative Josephson, Representative Wool, Representative Johnson, and myself, Co-Chair Foster. A reminder, if folks can mute their cell phones, and at this meeting, we're going to hear the subcommittee closeout reports. The intention is to go through subcommittee reports grouped together by the chair of the subcommittee, and I expect we'll spend about 10 minutes on each subcommittee. We'll begin with the Department of Administration with Representative Wool as the subcommittee chair, and then continue with Representative Wool on the Department of Labor, Revenue, and University. And so with that, I would like to invite Representative Wool's staff, Ashley Carrick, to the table, and if you could put yourself on the record.
Good afternoon. For the record, Ashley Carrick, staff to Representative Wool. So if I could direct members' attention to the narrative report for the Department of Administration. Our subcommittee held 8 meetings and submitted the following report to the House Finance Committee. In total, we have $284,812,700 in funds. This is made up of $67,420,400 UGF, $27,091,600 in designated general funds or DGF, $188,991,300 in other funds, and $1,309,400 in federal funds. The unrestricted general fund difference between FY22 adjusted base and the subcommittee's budget recommendation is an increment of $1.2 million in unrestricted general funds, which is 1.8% above our FY22 adjusted base. The total difference for the Department of Administration is a reduction of $11,921,300, which is 4% below FY22 adjusted base. In total, the department has 1,259 positions. And at this time, I'll go through a few of our significant budget actions. For the budget actions, the subcommittee examined the governor's budget proposal. First, there was an acceptance as a part of the department's procurement consolidation efforts to add interagency receipt authority totaling $5,977,000, as well as $200,000 in surplus federal property revolving fund dollars. We also accepted the governor's proposal to eliminate the statewide single audit contract totaling $450,000 in UGF. We accepted the governor's one-time UGF increment of $1.65 million for maintaining the biweekly payroll transition. We also accepted the governor's proposed decrements to the Information Services Fund totaling $15.198 million due to savings in the Office of Information Technology. Additionally, we denied the governor's proposed reduction in risk management for $3 million in interagency receipt authority, as this decrement should be reflected in the House Bill 102 fiscal note. Next, we denied the governor's proposed increment in the Public Defender Agency of $86,000 of Mental Health Trust Reserve funds on the ground that these funds were not initially approved by the Mental Health Trust Board. We also denied the governor's decrement to the Alaska Public Offices Commission and one law office assistant position. We denied the governor's reduction in the Office of Public Advocacy for $854,400 in UGF, as that proposal also required legislation for statute change. Next, we denied the governor's proposed closure of 6 Division of Motor Vehicle offices, including 6 customer service positions. This was a $582,500 proposed decrement in receipt authority, and those offices that are scheduled to remain open after subcommittee action are Eagle River, Toke, Valdez, Homer, Haynes, and Delta Junction. And finally, we accepted a member amendment to document $264,200 in receipt authority to eliminate the Office of Enterprise Analytics and two permanent full-time positions in that division. And that completes the report, and I can take any questions the committee has.
Thank you, Ms. Carrick. And so it looks like, just speaking to just UGF only, DOA is up by $1.2 million, but that's not because of any subcommittee member amendments or anything. That's purely due to accepting some of the governor's both increments and decrements, which had a net gain of $1.2 million. Is that correct?
Through the chair, that is correct.
Questions, Representative Wolf?
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I didn't have a question, but I was going to just add to your comment that the proposed one-time UGF increment of $1.65 million for the biweekly payroll transition, that was a large part of the increase that you mentioned.
Great. Thank you for that clarification. Do we have any questions or comments? Seeing none, we'll move over to the next department. Ms. Carrick?
So at this point, through the chair, I would direct your attention to the Department of Labor's narrative. And for the Department of Labor and Workforce Development, our subcommittee held four meetings. The total funds for this department are $151,522,200. This is composed of $17,725,300 in unrestricted general funds, $38,899,700 in designated general funds, $17,416,400 of other funds, and finally $77,480,800 in federal funds. This department has a total of 735 positions. And the UGF difference between FY22 adjusted base and the subcommittee's budget recommendation is a decrement of $1,300,000 of UGF, which is 5.3% below the FY21 adjusted base. And it's accounted for in the bullet points on your narrative report there that were acceptance of the governor's changes. On the second page for budget actions, we did accept the governor's budget proposal with three amendments. We denied the decrements for three different positions in the Department of Labor. One was for a research analyst 3 position in labor market information. Another was for an office assistant 2 position in wage and hour administration. And the third was for an administrative assistant 1 position in occupational safety and health. And this completes the report for Department of Labor.
Okay. Representative Wold, did you have any comments on this one?
No, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Do we have any questions of the committee, comments? Seeing none, I don't have any either. So, Ms. Carrick, the next department.
So, through the chair, we're actually going to move forward to the university's closeout narrative, and then we'll backtrack to Mr. Alper for the Department of Revenue. So if you can take a look at the University of Alaska narrative. So this is, I apologize, a review for this committee, as we did have a subcommittee of the whole for the university. The subcommittee met 4 times and submits the following report. In total, the university reports $795,830,500 in total funds. This is composed of $272,733,500 of unrestricted general fund, $310,755,000 in designated general fund, $75,116,100 in other funds, and finally $137,830,500 of federal funds. This is a UGF difference between FY22 adjusted base and the subcommittee's recommendation of a decrement of $4,300,000 of unrestricted general funds, which is 1.6% below the FY22 adjusted base. Additionally, the total budget difference for the University of Alaska between FY22 adjusted base and the House subcommittee budget, including all fund sources, is a reduction of $36,345,000, which is 4.4% below the FY22 adjusted base. In total, the university has 4,031 positions. And then on the budget action section, the House Subcommittee for the University reviewed the budget as well as one member proposed amendment. In our subcommittee, we accepted the governor's proposal, including a $20 million decrement to the University of Alaska. This represents the third year of the decrements outlined in the compact agreement made by the UA Board of Regents and the governor to take effect between FY20 and FY22. Additionally, we accepted the governor's proposed decrements in receipt authority. First, a $17,214,500 decrement to align with revenue reductions for tuition and fees for FY22. And we also accepted another receipt authority decrement from the governor of $4,785,500 to transition the University of Alaska Foundation to a nonprofit. We also accepted the governor's proposed structure change to consolidate university allocations into a single appropriation. And finally, we accepted a member amendment to add $15,700,000 to the University of Alaska in UGF funds. This amendment was to restore funding losses that were sustained through the uncertainties of the COVID-19 pandemic last year. And this completes the report, and I can take any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Carrick. And so the net reduction, it was accepting the governor's decrement of $20 million per the compact, and then the lost revenue relief of 15.7. So the net reduction for UGF is about $4.3 million, as I understand it. And just to refresh my memory, I think the compact, the three-year compact, the first year was a $30 million cut, the second was 20, and the third was 20. That's the total 70, or do I represent a whole?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The compact was, the first 2 years were $25 million each, and the last year was 20. Mm-hmm. So it was 25, 25, 20, $70 million total. This was the last year.
Okay.
As you stated, we accepted it, but then added back a good share of it. So it's a net reduction of $4.3 million.
Perfect. Thank you. Do we have any further questions or comments on the university? I don't see any. So with that, revenue. Mr. Ken Alper, if you can put yourself on the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Ken Alper. I'm the staff to Representative Wool and staff the Department of Revenue Subcommittee. I guess the highest level point here with the four meetings of the subcommittee, the budget that came out of the committee was identical to the governor's amended budget. No changes were made in their process. The total budget coming out was $25.8 million of unrestricted general funds, $3.8 million designated, $259.7 million of other state funds, and $79 million federal funds for a total of $368.3 million. That other state funds is a big glaring number that mostly it's non-unusual things. The largest two items were the fees from the permanent fund to pay for their own management of their funds, as well as the receipts of the Housing Finance Corporation, their rents that come in that they spend in their own management. The general fund number of $25.8 million was about a $2 million cut from the previous year, but of that $2 million, only about half a million, about a quarter of the cut, were true reductions, some of that in reduced positions, and some of that efficiencies from moving some of their computer servers in the child support division to the cloud. The other $1.5 million in GF cuts were really a switch from unrestricted to designated general fund. You saw where the Treasury Division is starting to charge fees for the management of some of the funds that they control, 0.1%, or what the bankers call 10 basis points for the Power Cost Equalization Fund, the Higher Ed Fund, and the Public School Fund. They're charging a little bit of a fee for their management, and that moves some of their costs to DGF. The total number of positions at Department of Revenue is 859. That's a reduction of two from FY21. That represents three cuts and one new position being added. And as I said, Mr. Chairman, at the beginning of my presentation, although no changes were made from last year, there were two issues that the committee debated at some length and wanted to bring to the full Finance Committee's attention. The first was the issue of corporate income tax auditors and the tax division. You may recall, I know Representative Thompson was central in this at the time, Two new auditors were added to that group in FY18. Those auditors are on the payroll and have cost the state a total aggregate over the 3 years of about $700,000. And we've identified $12 million worth of additional audit revenue that they've brought in. Faced with those facts, the subcommittee contemplated wanting to add another couple of new auditors, believing that they would be of a net fiscal impact to the state, finding money that's otherwise left on the table. That's a good multiplier, $700,000 to $12 million, and thought the committee might want to consider that. The second issue has to do with a new program of incentive bonuses that the Permanent Fund Corporation is putting in this year for their investment officers. This program was actually approved last year, although the Governor Dunleavy vetoed that addition in the budget. This is right now about a $900,000 increment. However, they have an algorithm, they have a formula. The head of the Permanent Fund, Ms. Rodell, came to Representative Wohl's office and talked about the program. They clearly have a plan and a system. It's something we should watch closely as it develops, but it is a whole new world of giving incentive bonuses to investment officers. And with that, that completes my narrative, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Okay, do we have any questions of the subcommittee? Representative Josephson?
Through the chair, Mr. Alpert, the second bullet about the incentive program, the middle lines there, the implication is that lower level investment officers would not receive the full allowable level? Is that what you're saying?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, their formula said that the higher level, the senior officers could get up to 50% of their base salary, and some of the junior folks could get up to 15 or 30%, depending on the category. But if you were to go through the math of the salaries of all the investment officers and their maximum allowable bonus, it would add up to about $2.7, $2.8 million. Only $900,000 was requested, and there was some concern that money could be monopolized by a handful of very senior executives, and therefore leaving none for the group behind. Ms. Rodell came in and clarified that the formula wouldn't really allow for that. It is going to get spread around. Inherently, the bonuses are skewed towards the higher-end people, but some portion of it will go to the lower salaried people if they meet their investment targets.
Representative Josephson, is that okay?
Yes.
Okay. Representative Wohl?
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I just want to elaborate on a little bit, because this was the concern that came up in committee, that since initially the amount was 2.7 and it was reduced to about $900,000, that if a few people got a bonus of 100 or 150,000, that would suck up the 900. But as Mr. Alper said, Ms. Rodell came to the office and went through, first of all, to get the bonus, you actually had to hit certain benchmarks. It was nothing arbitrary or subjective about it. Secondly, based on past performance, not everyone's going to get all these bonuses, depending on what kind of fund you ended up managing. And so if they went through all the numbers from the last several years, and if everyone had the same numbers and hit all their bonuses, it wouldn't even really equal $900,000. So there was no risk of the bonuses going too much to a certain group of employees. And lastly, this structure was largely set up as a recruitment, because many of the new applicants who come to apply for jobs, one of their first questions is, do you have a bonus plan, as many other public, other states have this in place, as along with private institutions. So it's very industry standard. And to be able to tell a new applicant, yes, we have a bonus program, is a big inducement to hiring people. So even though for some people it's largely symbolic, they felt it was important, and they would still like to try it. So we left it in, and at the lower amount, it seems adequate to spread bonuses out.
Representative LeBon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And to follow up on Representative Wohl's comments, we attempted to put this in the budget the last two budget cycles when I chaired the subcommittee for revenue. And the model that I was looking at was based on private sector businesses. In my banking career, performance bonuses were very common. And they were paid out of profits, and they were paid out of higher performance achievements that they were earned in a sense. They were not an expense of the bank that was at the detriment of anybody else. It was earned by the performers at a higher level of performance, return on investment for the bank, or in this case, return on investment for the Alaska Permanent Fund. So in that sense, they're self-funding, and they're supportable by performance. And if the performance doesn't meet the standard, then they're not paid out. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Representative Wool.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for indulging me. I know our other ones went pretty quick, so I'll take a little more time on this. But also, these bonuses are based not on they're based on both 5-year and yearly averages. So you can't do a bunch of churning and burning at the end of a year to try to hit certain numbers. And the percentage of your salary that you get as bonus is preordained by your job description. It's not, again, it's not arbitrary. Oh, you're in the 25% group, you're in the 50% group. It's all preordained in the job description. There's only 6 overall fund managers that get the largest bonus, and many of them have been around for a long time. So as far as those positions, they're pretty secure. And because of the nature of the market, usually one category is up while the other category tends to be down. So they ran the numbers again. If they had the 2.7 million that they had from previous budgets, they wouldn't have expended it all, because even if everyone hit all their bonuses, again, it would have hit about closer to this lower number. So anyhow, that's all. Thanks.
Thank you. Regarding the tax auditors, the recommendation is to finance to look at possibly adding one or more tax auditors. And I see here it says since 2018, the total cost for two of them has been about $700,000. And they've paid for themselves in terms of finding additional tax revenue, which is good. I'm just curious if we look at maybe adding some positions, maybe if there's some updated information in terms of like what the cost number we would put in for the FY22 budget if we were to add, say, one person. I could probably deduce and make a general, you know, assumption as to what that might be, but I was thinking, well, it's FY2022 now, 4 years later, how much more is the, you know, the cost per person with benefits as opposed to an average, which is what I would deduce that from. So anyway, I don't know if it's possible to maybe get us an updated number in terms of if we were to look at that. Mr. Alper?
Mr. Chairman, absolutely. Just broadly, the entry-level corporate income tax auditor is a range 18, auditor 1. Sometimes they're hired, if they have a little bit of experience, at the auditor 2, range 20. On average, these positions are going to cost the state all in with the benefit package about $120,000 per year each. There were amendments proposed in the committee and later withdrawn that would have funded one or two of them and used those numbers from the personnel books.
That is perfect. Thank you. Do we have any further questions? I don't see any. So with that, we'll move on to the next department. The next one is Representative Edgman has the Department of Commerce. And then after that, Representative Edgman has Corrections and Fish and Game. So with that, I believe Mr. Representative Edgman, are you going to be okay?
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I'd like to have my staff come up to the table. Seth Witten is a lifeline, and to be prepared to ask any detailed questions and to rescue me periodically as I do my best to walk through some high-level information on the three departments. Beginning with the Department of Commerce, I'd like to just, in terms of contextualizing things, the Department of Commerce is a vast department that over the last 8 years has seen its UGF levels cut considerably, some 83%, in fact, and of the $134.5 million funding for the entire agency, a little bit over $8 million actually comes from UGF or unrestricted state spending. It's also a department that did the yeoman's job in terms of work on the CARES Act this past calendar year, distributing some nearly $600 million to municipalities, as well as playing a big role in the Small Business Relief Act money. In terms of specific subcommittee recommendations, the subcommittee approved the governor's request to increase interagency receipt authority for the annual operations and maintenance costs for the prescription drug monitoring program. It also approved the governor's desire to transfer the economic development team, which was two staff members from the Department of Commerce, into the governor's office. The subcommittee denied the governor's request to remove $450,000 in UGF from the Alaska Legal Services Corporation. The subcommittee heard from agency staff that that was a request that came from OMB, but as we dug into it, we were told that Alaska Legal Services does an incredible amount of work for low-income people around the state in terms of civil cases. For every $100,000 of funding that the legal services get, it is able to provide benefits to 182 people, which in turn really alleviates the impact on the criminal justice system. Be happy to get in more detail if members want. The subcommittee also denied the governor's proposal to essentially transfer $847,000 from the PC endowment, which was not statutorily allowed for, but take that money and to use it for administrative services with Alaska Energy Authority, and we denied that. And Mr. Chairman, I see you looking at me sort of quizzically. Am I getting ahead of things?
Oh, the question, how many pages are in your report? We've got two. Right. Do you have more than two?
I am not going off the report. I'm actually going off my notes. Would you prefer that I go off the report?
No, that's fine. We just, I think, Mr. Witten, is the report, it should be two pages. Is that correct?
The Chair, yes. Seth Witten, staff to Rep. Edgman. That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Please proceed.
Okay, just a couple more things. We approved the governor's request to increase federal receipt authority for Alaska Seafood Marketing Institutes and Alaska Oil and Gas Commission to pursue essentially federal monies. And we also, to meet the increased workload for the Regulatory Commission of Alaska, approved the governor's request to add two utility master analyst positions. And Mr. Chairman, I think that completes the report on the Department of Commerce.
Okay. Do we have any questions or comments? Do you have anything to add, Mr. Witten?
No, just through the chair, if members are wondering, we hit the high points in the narrative that's in front of you. If you're following along on the BA sheets, you'll see some of the other things that Representative Edgman is referencing there.
Okay, and the BA sheet is, let's see here. Should be in the packets here. Yes, that would be, yep. Okay, well, if there are no questions, we'll move over to, I think, one more time, Representative Benjamin, you said this, over the years, this department has been cut by how much,
83% in UGF funds over the last 8 years.
Okay, thank you. Representative Ortiz?
Just a comment on that particular fact. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. While all the agencies have seen, most of the agencies have seen significant reductions, I don't think any agency has received a greater overall reduction than 83%. And when the subcommittee met, is there a sense from the administration that this agency is not needed? In other words, we're funding at such a lower level than what we have previously done. At a certain point, it seems to me from your report that we get a bang for our buck for the money that we invest in this particular thing. So I don't know. I'm just really perplexed that it kind of goes against the notion that you can't cut your way to prosperity. And it seems to me that we're trying to with this particular department, and I don't know. I just think it merits our consideration whether we want to continue down this path or not. Or anyway, for what it's worth, it's frustrating to see that with all the good things that this department does, that evidently it's not good enough because we continue to pay less and less investment to the department. Let's put it that way.
Any comments, Representative Edgman, before I go to the questions?
Well, thank you, Mr. Kochar. I would agree with the comments from Representative Ortiz, and I'd point out that the department is vast. It's not as big as the Health and Social Services Department by any stretch, but everything from Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute to Alaska Energy Authority to Community Regional Affairs to the Railroad to Occupational Licensing to Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation. And it, like a number of other agencies, has really trimmed its state spending and relies more on federal funding and in other fees and other costs that come into the department to run its annual operations.
We've got questions, Representative LeBon, and then Wohl.
And actually, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And that was my follow-up, was just to point out that they have not taken a 83% funding cut, but the allocation or sources of their funding has shifted, and they have not been stripped to the bone, as I understand it. Thank you.
Representative Wohl.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I had this budget last year, and as I recall, the economic development, which is in the title of the department, seemed to be shrinking, and some of those positions were now being moved to the governor's office under economic development, so which seemed a bit of a irony there. And I don't know if that's continuing, if they're still cutting, and then so the budget's getting smaller and people are getting smaller, but then in the governor's side sort of doing the same task, maybe under different supervision or salary structure, it's being moved to the governor's office. And is that still trying to happen or happening, I guess?
Representative Benjamin?
Yeah, so through the chair, the transfer of two positions related to economic development to the governor's office, in my memory, and I'll ask my staff to correct me, but leaves one staff left in the economic development division. And really, when you look at the department and what it does for economic development, and this is my characterization, most of that activity flows through ADEP, Alaska Industrial Development Export Authority, through loans and other sort of services that it provides around the state. And the whole notion of having staff to do other things related to economic development, as you point out, has really, that role has changed because there are less staff, in fact, just one in the department now to do that kind of work.
Okay. Representative Josephson?
Through the chair, Representative Edgman, the legislature, especially in 2019, resisted the movement of these economic development team personnel to the governor's office. Can you remind us, to your knowledge, why we resisted that, and in the end, did that simply happen in any case, or?
Representative Benjamin?
Mr. Chair, I think I would defer to the chair of the subcommittee at that time, who's sitting right next to you, Representative Joseph.
Representative Wohl?
Thank you. Through the chair, I'll dig through my memory banks. I believe we denied some of it, and I think some of it happened anyways, and I'd have to look at my notes. But at the time, I remember saying economic development should probably stay in economic development, and there was a team in the governor's office as well, and they tried to move some of the positions into the governor's office. We denied some of that, but I don't know the final status of it, honestly.
Okay. Well, if there are no further questions, Representative Ortiz, sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In reference to Representative LeBon's point about how they haven't actually received a full 89% reduction, when you consider other funds that have replaced that, I'm sure that's very, very true. However, just can anybody reference for me, when we look at 519 positions now, today, in 2021, does anybody know how many positions they had 5 years ago or anything like that? Does anybody have a sense for that?
Mr. Witten?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, I can't speak to 5 years ago. I can tell you that as of the FY21 management plan, they had 525, and this so this proposed budget represents a cut of six there.
Six positions.
That's correct, yeah.
All right, anyway, thanks.
Okay, if there are no further questions, we'll go over to Department of Fish and Game, Representative Edgman.
All right, thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. So the Department of Fish and Game, I guess just as an opening comment, this is also an agency that's seen a lot of reduction in state UGF over, in fact, the last 10 years, a 52% reduction and it's a department that's comprised of about a quarter sort of unrestricted state spending, and then three quarters everything from federal, other, to designated general funds, and so forth. The subcommittee held six meetings and have a number of recommendations to put forth. Again, I'm going to do my best to kind of walk through these and ask Seth to help me out if I need to. The major action that the subcommittee took was essentially in the Division of Commercial Fisheries, which is the most significant part of the department and the division that gets the lion's share of unrestricted state funding. But we approved the governor's request to consolidate all the budget components into a single appropriation line item instead of having appropriations to all the regional entities around the state. And while the regional allocations will be sort of lumped into a single line item, and this was done for efficiency purposes and to make things a little smoother in department level, the regional management structure will remain the same, and that the department assured us that the projects that the agency undertakes will still be available to be tracked and managed on a project basis level. The subcommittee also addressed a projected shortfall in funds appropriated from the Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission by eliminating hollow receipt authority of $716,000 and replacing it with funds from the general fund program receipts generated by commercial crew fisheries license fees. The subcommittee approved the governor's request to align budget authority to reflect an expected increase in Pittman and Robertson receipts, I think largely tied to an uptick in the sales of guns and ammunition and whatnot, and gave the department more federal receipt authority to essentially bring in more federal dollars that would go towards the wildlife and conservation appropriation line item. As I mentioned a moment ago, you know, we consolidated all of the regional allocations into a single appropriation line item. The subcommittee, along with doing that, also added separately intent language to require the department to produce a report updating the legislature on the impact of that consolidation within the commercial fisheries appropriation. And then lastly, the subcommittee approved shifting $62,200 from the Wildlife Conservation Appropriation to the Commercial Fisheries Appropriation to reopen the Wrangell Fish and Game Office, and that came at the behest of Representative Ortiz. So, thank you,
Mr. Okay. That
includes the fish game report.
Great. Do we have any questions from the committee? I don't see any questions, so thank you for that. Next, we'll go over to after fish and game. I think that's everything for you, Representative Edgman, is that right?
Confirming corrections.
Oh, corrections. Sorry, I had that right in front of me. Representative Edgman.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. So the Department of Corrections, very much in contrast to the Department of Commerce and somewhat to the Department of Fish and Game, has the fifth largest departmental budget of $394 million. And on a UGF basis, unrestricted state spending, it's of that nearly $400 million, about $350 million of that is actually just pure state funding. This is a department that doesn't have any money coming into it, but, of course, relies largely on state funding in order to be operational. The subcommittee recommendations, the first item was to approve the governor's request to back out $16 million, which last year was used for capital expenditures related to the opening of the Palmer Correctional Center. We backed that out of this year's budget because it wasn't necessary. And we also, subcommittee also approved the governor's request to transfer $14.8 million from the Institutional Director's Office to essentially fund FY22 operational activities for the Palmer Correctional Center. And you know, this is amount that's tied per the second year to House Bill 49, which the legislature passed in 2019. And the Palmer Correctional Facility, as I understand it, is on its way to being opened up later on this year. But it's you know, it's involved a journey. It's involved a fair amount of money, and it's been a sort of a multi-phase process.
The subcommittee also approved the governor's request to add funding for CRCs, which are otherwise known as halfway houses, and for electronic monitoring. The subcommittee added 112 new beds at Parkview CRC, which is in Anchorage, the tune of $3.9 million in UGF, and then also added $461,000 for GPS tracking for those who are involved in halfway houses or CRCs. And that's viewed as a cost-saving mechanism because those that are on electronic monitoring, of course, have the ability to get health care benefits outside of sort of the correctional the department itself, and that would save money in the long run, as well as of course GPS tracking allow for the better sort of monitoring of people who are out on ankle bracelets, quote unquote. The subcommittee approved a fund source change for anticipated increase in funds available through municipal and federal mandate billing. We approved the governor's request to fund six health care providers, and this again ties to House Bill 49, passed a couple years ago, and the six health care providers would be utilized at the Palmer Correctional Center. The subcommittee denied the governor's proposed structure change to move the electronic monitoring and CRC appropriations back into the population management appropriation, feeling that it would allow for better tracking of the funds being expended for the purposes thusly involved. The subcommittee denied the governor's request to replace $4.3 million of unavailable restorative justice funds with an equal amount of general funds and the physical health care allocations. And I'm going to stumble through this, but I think it's important just to say that the restorative justice account, restorative justice funds are funded by money coming from permanent fund dividends from inmates, and that money is in turn used to fund the physical health care allocation portion of the department. And with the number of inmates down in the department as a whole, there were less amount of PFD money coming in, and so we just sort of trued it up. Less money coming into the health, the restorative justice funds, and less money going in the physical health care allocation component as well. Lastly, we inserted an intent language directing the department to renegotiate contracts with community residential centers from a tiered rate structure to flat rate contracts, with the intention of receiving the most cost-effective use of the CRCs, essentially trying to, encouraging the department to employ a billing rate that'd be more commensurate with the amount of costs involved with having inmates, I can't think of a better term to use, but having, people involved in the CRCs. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I've stumbled and bubbled my way through that report, but my staff can clean up a lot of things of those questions. Thank you.
Mr. Witt, do you have any comments?
Mr. Chair, no, I do not.
Okay, thank you. We'll go to questions here. I've got one. And Representative Wohl might be able to refresh my memory on this, and I've got a question regarding the recruitment and retention of the correctional officers last year. I know Representative Wohl spent a lot of time on that and actually had an appropriation put in for that, and my question is, did the correctional officers reach out this year to the subcommittee hoping to restore those funds? I guess if you could answer that question, and then maybe Representative Wohl might have some comments or might be able to refresh your memories on that a little bit. Representative Edgman or Mr. Witten, did they reach out to you at all?
Yes, through the chair, Seth Witten, staff to Rep. Edgman. The correctional officers did reach out. They had a request to make a structural change, and it was not related to the hiring of recruitment and retention unit.
Oh, okay. So they did not have a request for that, but they did reach out on other issues then?
Their concern is getting correction officers in the recruitment unit. Which there's been some discussion with the department about how to make that happen. Their feeling was that a structural change to move two PFTs to the population management appropriation would enable correctional officers to work in that recruitment unit, but the structural change was not in the purview of the subcommittee.
Okay, and I forgot, I left out a big piece of this, and that is the money was appropriated, but then the department ended up using the money for other purposes, as I recall, or maybe I'm wrong. Representative Wolf?
Through the chair, if you give me just a minute, I do have notes on recruitment and retention. The department was slow in deploying the recruitment unit, but my understanding from documents that they provided to the subcommittee is that they are moving ahead. I've got a report in front of me that compares 12/30/2019 to 12/31/2020. And I show that in terms of recruitment results in 2019, there were 1,728 correctional officers. And as of 12/31/2020, this report shows 1,888. Also increases in adult probation officers, medical, mental health professionals, and critical support positions.
Representative Wolf, did you have a...
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, through the chair. Last year, they approached us about setting up a recruitment unit because of the number of corrections officers was, they were understaffed, basically, and a lot of overtime hours, a lot of money being spent on overtime. So we appropriated, I think, $400,000, some of which was for marketing, and some was for some positions. And once that unit was starting to be set up, then later the corrections officers union approached me and said, no, we wanted all corrections officers in that unit, which didn't come up in our meetings beforehand. And the department said, well, if you want three people, it has to do with the cost and seniority of corrections officers that would be available for that job, and the salary and benefits is quite high for some of those senior members. So they told me they would, the department was going to set it up with two recruiting professionals and add a manager and an admin person, and then staff it with a third person that would be a corrections officer on a TDY basis, 6 months to a year. So they wouldn't lose their corrections officer status, but would be then they'd rotate different ones in for up to a year at a time. I just got a letter saying that that third position hasn't been put in, but I reached out to the department, and I don't know what the full result is. And I guess the real question is that Mr. Whitten just answered is the problem of staffing being solved? Because I think that's really the issue that came before us before, was that there's a shortage of corrections officers, especially with the new facility opening. They'd need more officers. Plus, there's just a general baseline of attrition. And to try to offset that, they need to hire people quickly. And get a lot of people hired. So, and I think they got a slow start to setting up the unit. I think it's 2/3 set up right now, from what I hear, and I'm waiting to hear back from the department. But I'm also curious to see if the recruitment numbers are building and the hiring numbers are getting up, so they're properly staffed.
And I just wanted to make sure that they're a part of this process and that their concerns and needs were being addressed. Representative Whitten? I mean, Mr. Whitten. You got a
through
promotion.
The chair, just for the record, I wanted to make sure to say that I believe the appropriation in the previous year and the same appropriation this year for that recruitment and retention unit is $738,600.
We'll go to other questions. We have Representative Rasmussen and then Representative Johnson, then LeBron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I guess it's more of a comment. We did learn during the closeout, I believe, that we could charge fees to the CRC residents, where we have a cap with inmates in general population, and it's my intent to work with the department on finding a way to move forward and include some receipt authority for those people who are living in the community residential center because I do find it alarming that our corrections budget for UGF dollars is still higher than what we're spending on the university and other important departments. And I'm hoping that we can find a way to utilize as many other fund sources and eliminate some of the general fund spend. So I'm hoping we can have more conversation about that in full committee.
Thank you. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and through the chair to Seth Whitman, Mr. Whitman. I'm looking at the where it says insert an intent language directing the department to renegotiate contracts with the community residential centers to flat rate contracts with the intention of achieving the most cost-effective usage of CRCs. I was wondering if you have a projection report that actually shows this, because I have some information that shows that this actually is not going to be a cost savings, but I wanted to double check any information that you had and any projections that you had on that.
Sure. Through the chair, Seth Whitten, staff to Rep. Edgman. What has been happening with the tiered rate structure at the CRCs is that administrative costs are front-loaded, and so if the CRCs are full, then you're getting a more cost-effective deal. You're paying a cheaper price per individual living there. But because they haven't been filled, we're actually paying more for CRCs than we were under some flat rate contracts, is my understanding. And I'd be happy to get some information to you on that.
Very good. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Representative LeBon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was going to make a comment and had a question before we let Representative Edgerman off the hook for his presentations. A similar comment to the difference between the University of Alaska and the and Department of Corrections budgets, how those lines have crossed. And I know the university does the best it can to collect revenue from students through tuition. We just have to figure out a way to charge prisoners tuition to be in the prison system, so maybe beef up their funding. Probably not going to happen. But my question was, on a more serious note, the Department of Fish and Game, with the position that was established in Wrangell, did the agency or department have a position on that action to shift money from the wildlife conservation section of the budget to fund this position in Wrangell, or were they neutral on it? Were they okay? Do you have a little bit of insight as to how and why that happened?
Representative Ortiz.
Surely, Representative LeBon. Well, to begin with, it wasn't a creation of a position. It was a restoration of keeping the office open, was a restoration of an action that the governor took in the previous budget cycle, which was to close the Wrangell office. We attempted to, I was the subcommittee chair in the previous budget cycle, and we attempted to reverse that proposed action, and we got it all the way through the budget process, but then the governor vetoed it anyway. But so it's not a creation, it's an attempt to restore. And the overall motivation to do that was similar to, you know, the feedback we've received from the department on the proposed cuts to the Department of Motor Vehicles, of the six closures of those different offices, that represented, you know, an action that was not acceptable to many of these communities because they needed to, you know, have access to DMV offices and the services that they provide. I heard from my constituents in Wrangell, you know, that with the closure of that office, they were unable to do certain things. Like one of the main activities is to hunt moose on the Stikine. But now, with the closure of the office, they've got to go to Petersburg to get the tags for those moose, if they in fact harvest the moose. And you know, Petersburg is not road access. It's, you know, you have to fly to get there, or ferry. But then again, the ferries aren't operating. So it's been very problematic. To get to your particular answer, was the department supportive of it? I'm not sure that the game department was supportive of it, but they probably weren't supportive of it, but at the same time, my constituents were supportive of it. And so, again, you know, I have no apologies to make in terms of responding to my constituents who saw a real change in the way that they do their day-to-day business because of the fact that their fish and game office has been closed. So, in any case.
Thank you for that explanation. Thank you.
Representative Wool.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, I guess I have a question about corrections and maybe a comment since my question is, and I don't know if this came up in the budget subcommittee, but about visitation, there's been over a year with no visitation to any of the inmates in the correctional system. I don't know if that's about to change with vaccines being prevalent, whether inmates or and staff are, for the large part, being vaccinated, and if that will allow family members to visit the incarcerated again. And I don't know if this came up. It's not necessarily a budget item. Back to university versus prison, that those lines crossed, I think, last year. One, we've been cutting university pretty steadily, and we've been increasing corrections due, as was said, HB 49, where we're keeping more people in jail, and more than half the prison population is on pretrial, so they haven't even necessarily been convicted yet. But I think that had to do with legislation. SB 91 was largely repealed, and that made a lot more people have to be sentenced, but incarcerated. But is any word on visitation, I guess, is my question.
Through the chair, what I do know, and we did briefly just in our overviews touch on the fact that the department has had significant challenges, obviously not just with visitation, but with isolation, quarantine, all sorts of things with the pandemic over the last year. We did not get into discussing policy and when they will be changing, you know, policies around visitation or some of the other things that they've had to do to try to mitigate the pandemic.
Okay, Representative Josephson.
Yes, Mr. Chair, just a comment on the corrections budget and the recruitment effort. I had a phone call yesterday and was told that the officers themselves report that the department believes the funds that we allocated or appropriated need to be in the population management appropriation, that they couldn't be adequately spent or properly spent where they were housed. And I don't know if that was the commissioner's office or I don't recall where. Additionally, they want language that would staff the recruitment officers with actual corrections officers, not DPS personnel. That's apparently essential in painting a picture of what the work really is like. And I just wanted to share those things with the committee.
Great, thank you. Any further questions or comments? Seeing none, we will move on to the next department. Thank you, Mr. Witten. And next up, we've got the Department of Education with Representative Ortiz, and after that, he also has the Department of Environmental Conservation as well as Transportation. And I'd like to invite up Ms. Caroline Hamp to the table. And will you be presenting? Ms. Hamp, if you could put yourself on the record.
For the record, I'm Caroline Hamp, staff to Representative Dan Ortiz and the committee aide for the Department of Education and Early Development Finance Subcommittee. We'll be going over the deed narrative report, so if committee members are ready, I'll begin. The House Finance Budget Subcommittee for the Department of Education and Early Development submitted an operating budget totaling $363,663,300. Of that total, unrestricted general funds equal $58,950,500. Designated general funds equal $24,295,800. Other funds equal $33,234,500. And federal funds equal $247,182,500. The total funds in the House subcommittee budget is $1,417,000 less than the fiscal year 22 adjusted base, which is a decrease of 0.4%. of UGF only, it is 11,200 less than adjusted base, which is a decrease of 0.02, basically flat funded. In the subcommittee budget, there are 251 permanent full-time positions, 12 permanent part-time positions, and 3 temporary positions, for a total of 266 positions. The subcommittee adopted 32 of the 33 budget action items proposed by the governor. Of those action items, the subcommittee adopted the governor's proposal to use the Mental Health Trust Reserve to fund the Alaska Autism Resource Center. However, they also discussed regarding the funding source. There was also a discussion regarding the funding source, which resulted in an affirmative vote for intent language, requesting that the House Finance Committee determine an appropriate funding source for this allocation. This intent language is number one under wordage intent in the narrative report. The subcommittee rejected the governor's proposal to delete an education associate two position and instead recommends that the department use those funds to address the state board goal of supporting all students to read at grade level by the end of third grade. That intent language is number three under wordage intent in the narrative report. In addition to the changes to the governor's proposed action items, the subcommittee also considered multiple member amendments, primarily in the form of recommendations. The subcommittee passed intent language that federal funds will be used to create statewide standards for instruction in social and emotional learning, which is number two under wordage intent. The subcommittee adopted recommendation asking the House Finance Committee to consider a $5 million increment in UGF from lapsed funds to help fund the statewide pre-K grant program. The full recommendation is number one under recommendation in the narrative report. Lastly, the subcommittee adopted a recommendation asking the full House Finance Committee to consider a $635,900 increment in higher education investment funds to fund the statewide online library system. That recommendation is number two under recommendations in the narrative report. We've concluded going through the narrative report, and I'll be here, but also Representative Ortiz will answer any additional questions.
Okay, thank you. Questions from the committee, Representative LeBond?
You mentioned that an education associate two position was deleted in the budget.
We did not accept the governor's recommendation.
Oh, the recommendation to delete.
Right.
Was the position filled at the time, or was it vacant? Or did the committee know that?
My recollection was that it was vacant, but I'm not.
It was vacant.
It was vacant.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Hey, Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Chair. Ms. Hamm, can you remind me, the OWL program, was that, I think that was vetoed once, restored in FY20. I mean, I'm just curious what its funding was like in the current fiscal year.
Through the Chair, Representative Josephson, the OWL is funded this year. I'm flipping through my subcommittee to give you an exact number. This year it is funded at $472,400.
And similarly, pre-K, was that vetoed last April?
Through the chair, there were additional grants to pre-K. There were, in fiscal years, I believe, 19 and 20, there was an additional grant for pre-K that we tried to extend into fiscal year 21, and that additional grant was vetoed. There is still base funding for pre-K, but it is much less than the previous 2 years.
Thank you.
Do we have any further questions? I don't see any questions. So with that, we will move over to the next department, which is Department of Environmental Conservation. And looks like we have Liz Harpold, if you could put yourself on the record.
Thank you.
For the record, Liz Harpold, staff to Representative Ortiz. Does everyone have their DEC narrative?
Yes.
All right. The House Finance Budget Subcommittee for the Department of Environmental Conservation submits an operating budget totaling $80,164,500. Of that total, the unrestricted general fund amount equals $15,374,600. Designated general funds equal $24,627,900. Other funds equal $15,662,100. And federal funds equal $24,499,900. There is a small $140,000 decrease in unrestricted general fund use from the FY22 adjusted base to the House subcommittee budget, which is a decrease of 0.9%. In the subcommittee budget, there are a total of 473 positions, of which 472 are permanent full-time positions and the one temporary position. There are no permanent part-time positions. The subcommittee adopted 4 of the 9 budget action items proposed by the governor. The subcommittee adopted items related to the state revolving loan fund admin fee authority and using federal funds in this program, as well as deleting 3 vacant accounting positions and their associated funding. The subcommittee rejected the governor's proposal to replace CPVEC funds with UGF in the Division of Environmental Health and the reduction of 5 positions and associated funding within the Division of Spill Prevention and Response. Additionally, in addition to the changes to the governor's proposed action items, the subcommittee also unanimously adopted an intent language member amendment that requests the department provide to the legislature a plan detailing how they will pursue remediation of known sites and prevention of new spills. And that concludes my overview of the DEC narrative.
Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. It was brought to my attention, it was noted in one of the subcommittee meetings that the Department of Law had noted a legal memo that the use of the CPVEC funds for, what was the purpose on that one? For the shellfish testing was not legal. And then I believe that I had heard Senator Begich note in a Senate subcommittee that he had an opinion from Ledge Legal that that was not a legal use. Could you explain that a little bit further?
I'd like to defer to my boss.
Representative Ortiz.
Thank you for that question, Representative Rasmussen. The use of CPVEC funds for shellfish testing has been going on for at least the last 9 years or so. I think it's
more,
approximately about 9 years. And with the logic being that, those CPVEC funds come directly from cruise ship passengers. There's quite a bit of consumption of shellfish by cruise ship passengers on these vessels. The industry hasn't necessarily been opposed to use of these funds for this particular purpose. And we chose to reject the proposal to change it to direct operating funds, GF, because of the fact that GF, frankly, as we all know, is in short supply. And because it has been happening for the last 9 years or so without any opposition, we didn't think this was a good time to transfer it over to those services over to general funds. But I, your point was brought up in the subcommittee that there was a legal opinion that says that, perhaps this is an illegal action. That's been the point for most of these years, but it's never been challenged in court. So I would admit, and it's certainly going to be up to the committee here, as to whether or not, now would be a good time to change it over to direct GF for the funding of those services. It seems to me that it's not, but I'm open to the will of the committee.
All up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know if anybody is aware on this committee of how long the legislature intended to pay the testing fees for those businesses. I can't think of very many other industries who are 100% subsidized on fees that are related directly to their business being covered by the state. So I was just curious. I understand initially it was, we want to get this new industry up off the ground and running, and it's going to take 5 to 7 years before they start to see a return. And so I was just trying to understand that whole situation a little bit better.
Certainly, and I will only comment and say that, you know, the activity of testing for paralytic shellfish poisoning is a protection of the general public, and, it, you know, based on that logic, it would seem that it would be within the purview of the Department of Environmental Conservation to want to protect, participate in the protection of consumers in their consumption of shellfish. So that's what I was, I guess, say to that.
Have any follow-up?
We can talk about it.
Okay. Thank you. Representative LeBon and then Josephson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And along the lines of the five PCNs, reduced authority along with five PCNs in the spill prevention and response, were those positions vacant or were they filled?
To my recollection, I believe they may have been vacant. Can you help me out with that, Liz? I know that there was quite a bit of discussion about whether or not we should accept this reduction in positions, and that discussion included there was an elimination of, I think, 12 positions the year previous to that, and there's concern out there from the public about the activities of making sure that the spill prevention, the SPAR funds or the SPAR program continues to operate and does their job in doing the best that they can at both preventing spills and then participating in cleanups when they do occur. We had testimony that I believe there's in the neighborhood of perhaps, I can't remember the exact number, but there's a significant number of sites out there that are waiting attention from DEC that haven't received that attention, and these are sites that are not cleaned up, and you know, in those cases the public is not being protected, and so we felt like further reduction in this particular program was not the direction that the department needed to go in terms of them being able to continue to fulfill their duties at what they're supposed to do, which is making sure our waters and are clean, et cetera.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And in all fairness, of course, I don't know how many total staff positions they have and what their turnover rate is, and is vacancies, are these long-term vacancies, short-term conditions? I appreciate that. It's just curious if they're reducing staffing and affecting current employees, or they're just vacant positions that were cut back for whatever reason. But thank you.
Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple quick comments on that department. Because of a lack of a reduction in throughput, the amount of revenue the prevention section of SPAR gets is being reduced. And I attended a DEC subcommittee meeting at the invitation of Representative Ortiz, and I'm concerned because the department shows tables that their funding is going to drop off to nothing in the middle of this decade, and they don't really have much concern about it. In fact, the administration says the resolution of that, the solution rather, is more production.
So they want more oil so that the division has more work to do or more to fund. The answer to Representative Ortiz's question is 2,400 contaminated sites. The morale there is horrible. But my question is for Representative Ortiz. Representative Ortiz, what is the status of the monies that traditionally had gone to the Ocean Ranger program and that the department said it no longer wanted sight and sound, it wanted shore-based regulation, taking into account that we don't have cruise ships at the present time? What is your understanding of the funding?
First of all, the source of that funding is also cruise ship passenger vessel resources. And, you know, the general description we got from the department was that they have a replacement for the Ocean Ranger program, a replacement program in the works, but we haven't heard necessarily the specifics of that particular program. That's a concern because it's a concern to my constituents, I know that. So those funds, to answer what the status of those funds continue to pile up, if you will, although not very much piling up last year because there weren't very many cruise ship passengers last year. And there's not projected to be many this year as well. But prior to that, those funds, when they went unused, when the program was discontinued, continued to pile up because, you know, there's only limited ways those funds can be used. And one of those was the Ocean Ranger program. But again, their plan is to go to a different model, but we haven't heard the specifics of that model yet.
Ms. almost did that again. Ms. Harpold.
Thank you again for the record, Liz Harpold, staff to Representative Ortiz. I also want to point out that in FY21, $2 million of the Ocean Ranger fees were used for ambient water quality testing. They took advantage of not having ships around Southeast this last summer to get some baseline readings for water quality, and so that's where at least $2 million of that money went. But as far as we're aware, the rest of the money that might be sitting in that account has not been yet appropriated.
Okay, Representative LeBlanc.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if I could direct a question to Representative Josephson, I think I heard the number. You mentioned how many contaminated sites that
2,400.
2,400. And I'm going to guess that many of those sites might be residential or commercial, but non-oil industry sites. It's not from the oil industry that created all these contaminated sites. I'm guessing. Yeah. Thank you.
Representative Wool.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I, Representative LeBlanc, pretty much finished the question I was going to say, but 2,400 sites, and I think some of these could be a resident spilling a certain amount of diesel fuel, and I don't know what triggers it to be a site, what the threshold is. My understanding was it's pretty low. These aren't all major, you know, hundreds and hundreds of gallons or thousands of gallons of spill, but I don't know. I guess DEC could tell us more about that.
Representative Ortiz.
Thank you. I guess for further the discussion, in the course of these last meetings that we had in relationship to DEC, I was submitted a report that came from the EPA that basically does an analysis as to how well the state DEC does in their job of trying to protect and protect our waters and keep our oceans clean and do all that they do. And while the report was submitted not based on the performance of this under this current administration, it was previous to that, but the general report was that, you know, these guys are not doing a good job up there in Alaska, and the risk there is if that continues to be the case, we lose primacy and the feds take over. And so there's that we should consider as well when we look at the Department of Environmental Conservation and the duties that they perform. They perform them in lieu of EPA, but EPA ultimately has the authority to step in if they're not necessarily happy with what they see is happening in the state of Alaska, then we do risk the potential of losing primacy and the ability for the state to take care of protecting our waters and rivers and things like that could be lost to the federal government. So there's that as well.
Okay, any further questions? Seeing none, we'll move over to the Department of Transportation. Ms. Harpold.
All right, again for the record, Liz Harpold, staff to Representative Ortiz. The House Finance Budget Subcommittee for the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities submits an operating budget totaling $676,193,200. Of that total, unrestricted general funds equal $152,552,400. Designated general funds equal $47,230,200. Other funds equal $417,615,000, and federal funds equal $58,795,600. There is a small $1,193,800 increase in unrestricted general funds from the FY22 adjusted base to the House subcommittee budget, which is an increase of 0.8%. And I just want to note that this was from voting to accept or reject different budget action items. It does not come from any member amendment. In the subcommittee budget for DOT, there is a total of 3,355 positions. 2,929 of those are permanent full-time positions, 281 are permanent part-time positions, and 145 are temporary positions. The subcommittee adopted 36 of the 45 budget action items proposed by the governor. The subcommittee adopted items related to the Division of Facilities Structure Change, adding UGF for collective bargaining agreements, replacing Motor and Aviation Fuel Tax Receipt Authority with CARES Act funds due to projected revenue shortfalls, the reopening of the Silvertip, Chitna, and Birch Lake maintenance stations, among a few other items. The subcommittee rejected the governor's proposal to replace UGF with federal FAA CARES Act funds for rural airport operations and reduce, and also rejected items related to reducing the AMHS federal operations budget. In addition to the changes to the governor's proposed action items, the subcommittee also considered two member amendments that were both adopted. The first amendment was adopted by a vote of 5-2. It removes AMHS funded receipt authority from the entirety of the DOT budget. $49,940,000 of federal receipts is used to replace AMHS fund within the AMHS appropriation. Additionally, $1,945,100 of UGF was moved from marine vessel ops to various non-AMHS DOT appropriations to replace AMHS fund authority in those appropriations. And then that UGF amount was replaced with $1.9 million in federal receipts. This brought the full amount of AMHS fund replacement with federal receipts in the department to $51,885,100. The subcommittee also adopted an intent language amendment with a vote of 6-1 that requests the department to increase consultation and collaboration with local municipalities, including by establishing regional transportation planning organizations. And finally, the chair of the DOT budget subcommittee also wants to put forward additional recommendations that are not part of the operating budget, but are in regard to future appropriations the legislature may take. They were presented to the subcommittee before we closed out and discussed. And that concludes my review of the DOT narrative.
Okay, Representative LeBon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And looking at the first page of the summary, under designated general funds of about $47.2 million, is that gas tax receipts or not? Or could you tell me the source of those designated general funds?
I believe at least partially. I don't know if they make up all or, you know, come from
the fuel tax. So we cannot, if I may, Mr. Chairman, we're not able to dedicate funds to specific agencies, but in the case of a fuel tax, we can designate the funds on their budget. So if we do indeed pass the additional 8 cent per gallon fuel tax, then in some future budget cycle, we could see an increase in that line item.
Yep.
Thank you.
Further questions on DOT? I don't see any questions. So with that, Ms. Harpold?
I just want to point out that the AMHS fund is considered a designated general fund, and so that previously made up a big bulk of that fund source.
Do you know how much is currently in that fund?
In the Marine Highway Fund?
Mm-hmm.
I think we heard from the department in their presentation to us that it was near zero, if I'm not mistaken, before this particular action. If this action carries forward, then it would get replenished, but I believe we heard that it was getting way down there.
Thank you. Okay, I don't see any further questions on DOT, so with that, thank you. And we will now move over to Representative Josephson, as well as staff, Ms. Catherine Reardon. And we've got health, social services, judiciary, and law. So with that, Ms. Reardon, if you could put yourself on the record, and are you, I assume it's you presenting?
For the record, I'm Catherine Reardon. I'm an aide to Representative Andy Josephson. I'd like to give a summary of the narrative that is in itself a summary of the numerous actions taken by the Health and Social Services Subcommittee on this large budget. The budget being submitted by the subcommittee is $3,461,712,000, of which $1,115,600,000 is UGF. That is a $1,391,000 decrease in UGF from the adjusted base. The House subcommittee accepted some of the governor's requests for amendments to the FY22 adjusted base, denied others, and made a number of its own amendments. Highlights of these actions include that the subcommittee restored full funding of Medicaid services to the FY22 budget by denying the governor's $35 million decrement. This means that in the subcommittee's opinion, the carry forward language in the budget carrying forward $35 million should be reviewed in light of this subcommittee action. The next significant item or action taken by the subcommittee was the denial of governor's amendments that reduced the presence of children's services and juvenile justice staff in rural communities. The subcommittee took the position that delivery of those services electronically or through workers based in urban Alaska would be detrimental to the department mission. Some of the items that reflected this concern were cuts to positions in juvenile justice in Fairbanks, Valdez, Nome, and Dillingham, and also office closure reductions in Valdez, King, Salmon, and McGrath, and the Wrangell mayor's letter expressing distress about the impact of not having an OCS worker located there in that community. Another topic of significant concern to the subcommittee was addressing the critical and long-standing problems with recruitment and retention of caseworkers in the Office of Children's Services. The department spoke to the subcommittee about turnover that exceeded 50%, and the impact of that on the families, the children involved, and the inefficiency as well of constantly churning and having to review cases as they are passed from hand to hand through a series of caseworkers. The subcommittee decided to make a start at addressing that recruitment and retention problem by targeting funding for retention bonuses when caseworkers reach their 24th month in providing those services. Also, a behavioral health support worker for the employees of the division itself, as the department talked about the stress and really mental health cost of the vicarious trauma that workers who deal with those issues have, and that contributes to retention problems. So there is funding for some behavioral health support for the workers themselves, and also tuition reimbursement for professional education for caseworkers. That trio of retention efforts is, as I said, aimed at reducing the cost and inefficiency of the high turnover rate. Another significant decision by the subcommittee was to gradually reduce the number and funding of public assistance staff who process applications for Alaskans in need for a panoply of public assistance programs. The subcommittee decided to reduce those workers and associated supplies and postage funding more gradually than the governor proposed. The governor proposed 101 positions to be cut, and the subcommittee chose to take one-third as much of the cut in this fiscal year, and then to revisit it next fiscal year after having seen how technology rollouts actually play out. So the subcommittee took a $1,132,000 cut in UGF for public assistance staff who process applications in the belief that they need to make sure that the division has adequate resources if implementation of plan technology improvements doesn't proceed as quickly or as smoothly as intended. An example of what can go wrong was the delay in senior benefits this winter for 1700 low-income seniors when technology combined with remote work led to a multi-month delay in those benefits, and also the anticipation that there will need to be a significant purge of the Medicaid roles when the federal government stops prohibiting removal of Medicaid recipients, which may occur next December as part of the end of the COVID relief plan. When that occurs, there will need to be a significant work effort to, in a 60-day period probably, to purge the Medicaid roles of people who are no longer eligible, and the subcommittee wanted to ensure that there are enough positions and funding that if the division needs to staff up to meet that need, they'll be able to without a supplemental or without harm to the folks who rely on public assistance services. Another significant action of the subcommittee was to increase availability of behavioral health grants and also to increase the number of Alaskans who are eligible for the intellectual and disability waiver, to increase the number who are pulled off the 800-person wait list. This is something that the Key campaign often addresses with legislators. The subcommittee chose to increase from 50 to 70 the number of folks who can be pulled off that wait list in the coming year. The subcommittee also adopted a variety of intent language to reflect their views on a number of issues involving the budget. In terms of recommendations, the subcommittee strongly opposes the use of mental health trust reserve funds in the department budget and recommends change to another fund source. The subcommittee did support the activities, the items themselves, and therefore voted to accept those items into its budget, but that was contingent upon or with the expectation that the funding source would be changed. And as I said before, the subcommittee action to restore the $35 million in Medicaid means that the subcommittee is suggesting that the full finance committee review the carry forward language that achieves the same dollar amount. Thank you very much.
Do we have any questions or comments? Representative Wohl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The item of for OCS caseworkers, targeted funding for retention bonuses, behavioral health support, tuition reimbursement for caseworkers. Is this something that's done anywhere else? I've never heard of. I know the bonuses for the permanent fund investment people is sort of, as far as state jobs go, kind of unprecedented. So this is a bonus if someone stays on for 24 months. They get a little a cash bonus, I guess, and tuition to take education classes. Is this copied from another program within the state?
Through the chair, Representative, subcommittee's understanding that there is already a bonus in place for the caseworkers of $1,000. This would increase it to $3,000 to make it to that 24-month period. It is through a union agreement, the current $1,000. And the thought behind it is that when they hire a new caseworker, for the first year they're in a trainee status where they have a fairly low caseload and you know they're learning their job, and then after the first year they get bumped up to a full caseload, and the stress of that with unmanageable caseloads and turnover of their coworkers is such that a fair number give up. But if they can make it to 24 months, you know, get kind of on top of that wave, they might stay. And that $1,000 was perhaps not being effective in the way that, you know, $3,000 might be.
Thank you.
Ms. Reardon, I'll take this step by step regarding the Medicaid carry forward. And I'm just trying to look at the pros and cons of the recommendation here is for the full finance to look at the carry forward language. And so the first question is, the subcommittee has said that we will fully fund the $35 million with UGF, correct?
Yes, then, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And what the governor wanted to do is he wanted to carry forward excess Medicaid funds from FY21 to 22 for $35 million, and at the same time cut the FY22 budget by $35 million. So it would offset. There would be no real cut to HESS, but I think ultimately by doing that, what happens is the carry forward does not count as an add to 22, but it does count when you make the cut. So in effect, the governor can now say, I have cut the HESS budget by $35 million, but that's not what really happened. And then the other problem, if you were to do what the governor wants to do, would be, maybe Kelly Cunningham, if I have this wrong, please shake your head and we'll invite you up. But then what that would create is in FY23, if you're going to continue with that funding, well, now you have to add $35 million to the budget. So now you've increased. So you've kind of artificially decreased 22's budget and you've artificially increased 23's budget. You've created this little cliff type situation. Do I have that right?
Mr. Chair, that was the subcommittee's understanding that because the $35 million wouldn't be in the new fresh FY22 appropriation, it wouldn't go into adjusted base for FY23. And so in order to recognize the same level of spending in FY23, there would need to be a $35 million increment. While the subcommittee, I think, was interested in the possibility of finding ways to spend less on Medicaid while still providing adequate services, and did have testimony from ASHNA during their process about that, there wasn't any, despite prodding and poking, there wasn't any belief that $35 million was an achievable actual decrease for FY23, so we would be setting up for an increment being necessary.
Okay, thank you. Do we have any, I just wanted to make sure folks were understanding of the ramifications of whatever action we took on that. Any Representative Josephson?
And I'm sorry that Representative Wool isn't here, but I just wanted to make a couple of comments on the OCS item. The subcommittee heard about three or four slides of a PowerPoint. On the record were the top officials from the department, four or five of them. The director of OCS, Ms. Guay, she was allowed or chose to describe in some detail, like I said, three or four slides that utterly captivated the subcommittee, what was happening in her division. She described a 51% turnover. She described personnel who were essentially damaged by their experiences. That is, it was so traumatizing that they weren't the same leaving as they were coming in. And so the subcommittee heard that. There was already this $1,000 bonus. We found the resources without growing the UGF budget to pay a $3,000 bonus. And also, since there's over 200 of them, we wanted them to have a therapist, because that's what we were told, that they needed that to process. And finally, there was this modest tuition reimbursement. So the subcommittee responded, and it really was quite remarkable that the department said to one of its top officers, we want you to be fully candid about what's happening in your division. The subcommittee heard that and responded to it. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, I see no further questions for Hess. So with that, Ms. Reardon, we'll move over to Department of Judiciary, actually.
Mr. Chair, law or judiciary? It's judiciary next?
Either one. Whatever you pick.
Okay, I'll do judiciary. Okay. Oriented here? This is Catherine Reardon still. The budget of the judicial branch, which is forwarded to the legislature by the governor, the judicial branch's request is for obvious sensible reasons, primarily a UGF budget. The total amount of the budget submitted by the subcommittee is $116,287,000, of which $112,548,000 is UGF. The budget being submitted is 0.4%, about 0.5% above the FY22 adjusted base budget for UGF. And that difference is primarily the implementation of recommendations of the Legislative Task Force on Therapeutic Courts. The subcommittee recommends that the adjusted base budget be approved with three amendments. The most significant of those amendments is the $480,400 UGF increment presented for implementation of the recommendations of that legislative task force, as I mentioned. The task force recommended additional personnel to increase the effectiveness and efficiency of the therapeutic court system, consisting of one new prosecutor, one new public defender, and one person to oversee and coordinate peer support groups for therapeutic court participants and graduates so that they stay in a good direction after they finish the therapeutic court process. Although those positions will be housed in the relevant departments, funding is included in the judiciary's therapeutic court allocation. My understanding of the reason for the prosecutor and public defender is that dealing with the therapeutic court system is very different than the prosecutors and defenders are used to dealing in the regular criminal system, and that having one expert in the public defenders and one expert in the prosecutor's office who could help attorneys who weren't familiar learn how to work effectively with the therapeutic courts would, rather than each one having to figure it out on their own, you know, stumbling and maybe not even availing themselves of the therapeutic court when it would be advisable, that having these kind of mentor staff would be productive. The other minor change is $40,000 in interagency receipts to allow the court system to process marriage licenses for the Department of Health and Social Services in Fairbanks, which doesn't have a vital records office in Fairbanks and is requested that the court do those duties of applying for marriage license processing, and they'll pay the court to do it. So that seemed like a good cooperative venture for the subcommittee to support. And that is the end of my presentation on the courts.
Okay. Thank you. Do we have any questions? I see no questions, so we'll move over to law.
Law. Mr. Chair, the subcommittee on the Department of Law is forwarding a budget of $91,981,000, of which $54,704,000 is UGF. That is a UGF increase above adjusted base of $2,633,000. That UGF increase is comprised of a $3 million UGF increase for 19 prosecutorial staff proposed by the governor and accepted by the subcommittee, who are to be focused on prosecution of sexual assault and sexual abuse of minors cases. So there's a $3 million increment for that, and it is partially offset by a $466,000 reduction in UGF that the subcommittee initiated to the civil and administrative support appropriations. Highlights of the subcommittee action are that the subcommittee denied the governor's $1,290,000 fund source change from UGF to SDPR for prosecution of misdemeanors in home rule communities. The governor proposed to bill home rule municipalities for the level of misdemeanor prosecution that they currently receive from the state. The subcommittee perceived this as a cost shift to taxpayers in those communities without sufficient prior discussion with those local governments. The subcommittee reduced by $200,000 UGF funding for the contractual services line in the labor and state affairs allocation of the civil division to eliminate funding they felt was not required to maintain the department's core activities. The subcommittee also eliminated the vacant Deputy Attorney General position in the Office of the Attorney General and an equivalent amount of UGF funding. This position was created by the department through its management plan and filled in 2019. The position is now vacant, and the subcommittee voted to return to the previous management structure of two Deputy Attorneys General, basically the two Deputy Commissioner model rather than the three. Those two actions together added up to $466,600 of UGF. The recommendations the subcommittee had to make to the full finance committee included reinstating the FY21 appropriation structure on the civil side of the department so that there would be two appropriations one of those two appropriations being for legal contracts related to the interpretation of Janus v. AFSCME decision, and to put $20,000 in that separate appropriation for that need. The subcommittee also wanted to share its forwarded its position on two items in the supplemental slash capital budget for consideration by the full finance committee. The first is a $4 million supplemental item for prosecutor recruitment and housing. The subcommittee supports funding the requested activities, but found that the higher education fund source identified by the governor was inappropriate to the purpose. The subcommittee encourages the department to coordinate its rural housing project with HFC and other departments with similar needs, and hopes that the full finance committee will find an alternative funding source. The need for recruitment and retention, particularly of criminal division staff in rural Alaska, is real and urgent, and housing may help. The other position on the supplemental budget has to do with a separate $4 million item in the supplemental budget, which is for outside counsel to support statehood defense. It was the position of the subcommittee that the request is not necessary to address urgent FY21 supplemental needs and is more properly considered a multi-year operating budget increment and a FY22 operating budget request. The subcommittee recommends that the finance committee determines whether FY22 funding for statehood defense should be approved in the requested amount or in a lower amount or denied, but didn't feel that it was correct to present it as a supplemental item. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Do we have any questions for Law? I feel like I might have had one here. Let's see here. Oh, going back to the budget structure on page 2, the Janus v. AFS CME, that was in last year's budget, but it was vetoed, correct? And this would just be reinstating that?
That is correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Josephson?
So there were there were two structures created and then made law by the legislature last spring. One of them is in our subcommittee budget, but we didn't have authority to restore this other one. I would note that under one reading of a 2001 Supreme Court decision, the governor wasn't allowed to draw through the structure. Now, I've heard that there's a counter argument, but essentially, you're allowed to veto an item, and an item is money and a purpose, but it's not typically the RDU or the budget structure, and he drew through that. And anyway, just wanted to make that comment.
Thank you. Do we have any further questions or comments on Law? I see none. So with that, we'll go ahead and wrap it up for the day. We don't have that many more to go through tomorrow. We've got resources, public safety, military and veterans affairs, and then governor and legislature. So with that, we'll go ahead and wrap it up. And if there's nothing else to come from the committee, we will go ahead and adjourn. We are scheduled to meet tomorrow morning at 9 a.m., and we're going to hear consideration of the governor's appointees. And so with that, we will be adjourned at 3:29 p.m. Thank you.